From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's still unclear whether democracy will really take hold in Iraq, but at least one Western import does seem to be sticking: reality TV. Ever since the January elections there, one of the hottest primetime attractions has been a daily hour-long program on Al-Arakia, the state-run channel set up by American occupiers in 2003. The show is called Terror in the Hands of Justice, and it features captured insurgents, or alleged insurgents, confessing to their crimes: abductions, car bombings, rape, and beheadings. Sometimes they're berated by family members of victims on screen, all to drive home the point that these men are utterly contemptible, morally bankrupt, and in some cases even sexually deviant. Steve Negus wrote about the show last week for the Financial Times, and he joins me on the line from Baghdad. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Is the point to have a kind of Iraq's most wanted and to generate tips from the public? Is it to discredit and humiliate the insurgency? What are they after in airing these confessions?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, 3 months ago, you know, the insurgency was somewhat of an invisible, frightening, omnipresent force in a lot of parts of Iraq. If you were cooperating with the Americans or working with Iraqi security forces, it felt like it was all around you, watching everything you did, and if you stepped out of line, it would kill you. What this show has done is sort of put a human face, and not a very frightening or very sympathetic human face, of the insurgency. In many parts of Iraq, the insurgents are no longer figures of fear so much as they are figures of mockery. Combine this with the success of the elections, and particularly in many Shia areas, you know, people now are much less frightened about going to the police and turning them in.
Is there any doubt about the authenticity of this production?
Personally, I think that the people who they put on television are genuine insurgents, or people who they at least suspect of being insurgents. One of my friends recognized someone who had briefly abducted him. Whether the confessions are accurate or not is an entirely different matter. I suspect that, you know, the Iraqi police are not gentle people when they catch you. And, you know, I suspect there are beatings and probably worse forms of torture are not terribly rare when you're in their custody. And in general, I mean, I think, you know, once they've broken these suspects, that the suspect is going to tell them whatever the policeman wants to hear, no matter how outrageous it becomes.
Some reports of the prisoners who have confessed said that they have obvious bruises. In the episodes you've seen, have you seen anybody who's been clearly beaten up before their appearance?
I have heard that some of the prisoners have come on sporting bruises, but the prisoners I've seen, while some of them look emotionally broken, are not sporting any physical injuries.
Over the 2 months that Terror in the Hands of Justice has been on the air, have you noticed any change in the nature of the confessions, in their style, in their substance?
Iraqis tell me that it started off as very heavy on the people coming in from Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Syria, which is very much in line with trying to present the insurgency as something perpetrated by fanatics from outside Iraq. The show itself has apparently increased the number of tip-offs that the security forces are getting. So the pool of captives they have to draw from becomes ever larger and larger. I would imagine that the police probably have a preference for the insurgents who are going to be least sympathetic. More recently, the confessions have been getting wilder and wilder, to the extent where you have one supposed militant sheikh who's come on the air and claimed to have hosted gay orgies in his mosques under the theological justification that because these people were fighting for a religious cause, that everything would be forgiven, so why not indulge themselves in this life? And certainly that particular episode everybody was talking about.
I'm curious about the Geneva Conventions. There are specific prescriptions against humiliating prisoners. Have either the Iraqi or American officials had to defend themselves against what apparently is an explicit violation of the Geneva Conventions?
The U.S. and the Iraqi government line, I believe, is that insurgents are not subject to the Geneva Convention. U.S. military claims that it treats captives according to the terms of the Geneva Convention, but they don't feel they're legally bound to. As far as the Iraqis are concerned, these people are criminal suspects as opposed to prisoners of war. So prisoners in an insurgency are in a gray area. Legally, you can do quite a few things to them.
Al-Arakia is well understood to be a mouthpiece for the Iraqi government. Is there anyone who's actually watching this station?
Oh, yeah. No, it's the one terrestrial station that everybody watches. And, you know, it's not quite a mouthpiece in the same sense as, like, a state television in Egypt or Syria might be. I mean, it is allowed a fair amount of independence. I mean, it very much is a tool of the Iraqi government. And also, you know, the worldview put out by Arakia is not so different from that of many Shias. Since the elections, the views of the Shia majority and the views of the government are coming together somewhat. And they'll probably come together even more when a Shia-dominated government is finally formed.
What about the Sunni viewers? They see mostly Sunnis on television being humiliated. How is this playing among the Sunni minority?
Many Sunnis find it very insulting. They believe that their community as a whole is being demonized, is being, you know, portrayed as a bunch of terrorists. Several Sunni parties have called for this program to be taken off the air. And this is one of the reasons why this program is a bit of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, you know, it is effective in convincing citizens to come forward with information. But on the other hand, it further alienates the Sunni Arabs. And for the insurgency to go away, you know, the Sunni Arab community as a whole has to sort of be willing to throw in their lot with the new political system.
One last thing. When you go on American Idol, sometimes you get a recording contract. Sometimes you get famous for 15 minutes or so. It can change your life forever. The men who have been on terror in the hands of justice, what becomes of them?
Some of them will probably go on trial. Some of them might be amnestied, but I imagine they're not exactly reaping any benefits from their fame in the near future.
Okay. Steve, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Steve Negus is Baghdad correspondent for the Financial Times.
Iraqi audiences are at least getting some picture, albeit flawed, of the participants in the war there. Here in the U.S., we see Pentagon spokesmen and retired generals, but rarely the soldiers wounded while carrying out their decisions. We catch glimpses of them in a local paper's story on a hometown hero, in a PBS report, in a recent photo spread in the Sunday New York Times, but the picture is incomplete. Anyone can go to the Pentagon's own website to get the latest count of wounded in action. As of Thursday, that number was 12,005 for soldiers in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. But according to Salon correspondent Mark Benjamin, one of the very few reporters following the stories of wounded soldiers, that number is deceptively low.
What the Pentagon is doing is only reporting casualties who are hurt directly by the bullets and the bombs of the enemy. So in other words, if two soldiers are driving in Humvees, one is shot and wounded while he's driving his Humvee, he will show up as a wounded soldier. However, if the other one drives off the road and slams into a pole and breaks his neck and is paralyzed for the rest of his life, he does not show up as a casualty. The reason why that's such a strange practice is because the Pentagon's own definition of casualty includes anyone who is lost to the organization for medical reasons, whether that's an accident or a horrible illness that comes on in Iraq or whether it's by the bullets and bombs of the enemy. So what we're seeing is a low number. The total number, if you take the number of soldiers who have been evacuated on airplanes for medical reasons out of Iraq and Afghanistan, is more like 25,000.
So that's the data. Let's go to the images now. We heard about the ban on picture taking at Dover Air Force Base, where caskets arrived back in the States. But a recent story of yours suggests that the Pentagon is also trying to hide wounded from the eyes of the American public. Why do you say that?
The flights of wounded fly out of Iraq or Afghanistan to a hospital in Germany and then to Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. The Pentagon has arranged the schedule of flights so that they only land at night, usually quite late at night, you know, around 10 o'clock, sometimes much later. And then many of the most seriously wounded go to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., or if you're a Marine, possibly to Bethesda Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. Photography and reporters in general are barred from Walter Reed or from Bethesda from seeing those soldiers arrive at all. And just the simple fact that the flights only arrive at night has had the effect of essentially blinding the American people from a drumbeat of wounded.
Well, what reason has the Defense Department given you for the night flights?
The written response was that operational restrictions at the runway in Germany, plus the time it takes to get soldiers ready to travel, dictate the departure times from Germany and thus the arrival times in the United States. My reporting seems to indicate that the reasons described by the Pentagon do not seem to add up with a schedule of soldiers arriving here only at night. I would also add that a number of soldiers, if you run into them, who came here early in the war, who were wounded and landed at Andrews Air Force Base, say they arrived during the middle of the day. If that's true, the Pentagon has changed the schedule.
Well, what about after they land? Hospital officials have told you that the reason why you can't photograph them coming in is to protect their privacy. Isn't that legitimate?
Perhaps. One of the issues, however, is that they told me there were privacy concerns with respect to getting images of the soldiers. However, I was able to obtain images of the soldiers arriving at Walter Reed without showing their faces. It certainly was not a violation of privacy. And let me tell you, I went and witnessed some of these arrivals without the Pentagon's knowledge at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. It's very, very disturbing. The wounds are quite shocking.
Is it easier for you to get access to them while they're recuperating?
In general, the access is limited to situations that I think can be characterized as good news stories for the Pentagon. For example, one of the things that the Pentagon is doing a wonderful job at is caring for soldiers who have very serious injuries like amputations. And so the press is sometimes allowed to go and meet those soldiers and witness that good news story. I have found over the course of reporting this story that it is sometimes necessary for me to interview soldiers without, frankly, the interference of Pentagon officials, because I find that soldiers give me different answers when they know that they're being watched.
So, Mark, how did you get into Walter Reed?
I gained access to Walter Reed in order to most effectively report my story. I think I'll just leave it at that.
So you've been aggressive and maybe gone around the general channels. Do you think that other reporters perhaps have dropped the ball, that this isn't just a Pentagon problem?
I wish that some reporters would try harder to get just some of the basic information about this war clearly to the American people. You can think of example after example. I mean, what is it going to cost us to take care of all these wounded soldiers? How many people are actually suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder? How many soldiers have been sent to war in general? I think it's a little bit more difficult when we are in a situation where we don't have a divided government. I mean, for example, if, let's say, the Democrats ran the House and the Senate and the Republicans ran the White House, we would probably know a lot more about the torture memos and Abu Ghraib and what's going on in Guantanamo than we do now. In the meantime, I think that it would be helpful if more reporters were, frankly, less captive to their sources. I mean, it's tough, for example, for a Pentagon correspondent to really mix it up with the Army, because if you work in that Pentagon press room every day, they can cut you off and freeze you out. And I think some editors at least worry that sometimes their Pentagon correspondents are a little bit more captive to the Pentagon than they'd like.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Benjamin is a national correspondent for Salon.com.
Coming up, two court battles over intellectual property, Hollywood versus Grokster and France versus Google.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the United States Supreme Court heard the case of MGM versus Grokster. MGM represented the interests of both the motion picture industry and the major music labels. Grokster stood in for a number of peer-to-peer software manufacturers, software that allows anyone to freely trade material on the Internet. The entertainment industries say the software makers are arming pirates. The software makers charge the entertainment industry with trying to strangle technological innovation. It's not a new fight. 21 years ago, the motion picture industry argued before the Supreme Court that another technological innovation was going to be its downfall.
Today, a lawyer for Sony told the Supreme Court that taping programs to watch them later should not be considered a copyrights violation. Justices Berger and O'Connor asked, if someone's not home at 7 and watches at 11, what's the harm? Movie lawyer Stephen Croft replied it could cut into sales of rental cassettes and reruns of the program.
That's NBC News in 1983, when the film industry sued to stop sales of Sony's Betamax machine, the earliest VCR. It's a case that Fred von Lohmann, a senior attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who represented the software makers, believes directly parallels the case he made in front of the Supreme Court this week.
Actually, the case began back in 1976 when two major motion picture studios sued Sony. They said Sony should be held responsible for the copyright infringements made possible by the Betamax VCR, the first VCR for the home, just as they're arguing today that Grokster and Streamcast, who make the peer-to-peer file-sharing software, should be held responsible for infringements that this new technology makes possible. The Supreme Court in 1984 finally gave the first clear answer. They said so long as your technology is capable of substantial non-infringing uses, in other words, so long as it has good uses as well as ill, it's legal to sell it, it's legal to develop it, and thanks to that ruling, the engineers who have brought us things like the iPod and the TiVo and the personal computer and the internet, even Silly Putty, which after all can be used to lift text off of newsprint, they all have taken a great deal of comfort in that clear rule that has, for the most part, kept them out of court.
You might also have mentioned the Xerox machine, which is not exactly new technology, but can also be used and is used every day for illegal copyright infringement purposes, but it has other functions as well. Did it occur to you to just wheel a Xerox machine into the court?
Well, at least metaphorically speaking, one of the justices did it for us. Justice Breyer asked, "What about the Xerox machine?" And in what I thought was an interesting quip, he said, "After all, going all the way back to the Gutenberg printing press, there were a lot of monks out there that really weren't happy about that invention either." This is really part of a much longer historical set of fights between new technologies and the entertainment industry, going back at least to the player piano at the dawn of the 20th century. No less a figure than John Philip Sousa, the famous American composer, said, "The player piano will be the end of music in America. Nobody would ever buy sheet music ever again because from that point forward you could just have a player piano instead." The interesting thing is, although the entertainment industry has attacked the player piano, broadcast radio, cable television, the VCR, and more recently the MP3 player, in every single case, the new technology that was attacked ended up making more money for the very entertainment industry that had attacked it in the outset. There's no reason to think the internet is going to be the first technology in 100 years which doesn't create new markets for the entertainment industry.
So this week you had your day in court. How did it go?
Well, I think the justices asked all the questions we wanted them to ask. It was quite striking. Justice Souter, who I understand still writes his opinions longhand on yellow legal pads, started out the day asking a question about, well, what about the guy in the garage who invents the iPod? How do we make sure he's protected? So when Justice Souter starts with a question like that, in my view, he understood that innovation is really what's at stake.
We're going to speak next to Dan Glickman, the president of the Motion Picture Association of America. Now, the MPAA claims that peer-to-peer software is used primarily for pirating movies and music. And certainly the record industry will claim that the increase in the use of peer-to-peer file-sharing networks has tracked with a dramatic drop in their CD sales.
I think it's not at all clear that the CD sales can all be laid at the feet of peer-to-peer. The music industry has a host of problems, including, of course, their problem getting onto radio, the consolidation of retail. Frankly, I think peer-to-peer file sharing has become a convenient scapegoat for a business that has a lot of problems. But all of that being said, CD sales actually increased last year, despite all the file sharing and all of the complaints. And when it comes to Mr. Glickman, the motion picture studios, they are actually enjoying their most profitable years in world history right now and for each of the past 5 years. So it is far too quick to say these technologies are going to devastate the entertainment industry. After all, that's exactly the mantra they came up with during the fight over the VCR. Jack Valenti, who was then head of the motion picture studios, famously said that the VCR was to the movie studio as the Boston Strangler was to a woman alone. And of course, as people who've been paying attention will no doubt know, it's the home video market that the VCR made possible that became the biggest money-making bonanza the movie industry had ever seen.
The music and film industries have also been suing individuals for downloading material illegally. How are those cases going?
Well, it appears the recording industry is very serious about suing individuals, and the motion picture studios are beginning to get into that game as well. I think that's an unfortunate strategy. After all, it doesn't take a real genius to tell you that suing your own customers is not a business model. So I do think in the end they're going to have to recognize that they need to lure customers. It's about the carrot, not about the stick here.
All right, Fred. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fred von Lohmann is senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Former Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman is now the president and CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America. Mr. Secretary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have made the piracy issue the defining one in your first 6 months of your term. How do you think things went in front of the high court this week?
I think they went pretty well. The justices, at least eight of them, asked tough questions of both our counsel and the opposition counsel, but two or three of the justices said that the specific rule of the Sony Betamax case was not necessarily going to govern their decisions. A couple of justices talked about the whole issue of inducement, that not only that you have a system that allows theft to take place, but that you actively induce that. The court, I think, is particularly gifted at balancing the interests. They don't want to stop technology. That's a truism. They also don't want to promote lawlessness. That's a truism.
Now, our previous guest, Fred von Lohmann, argued against you in court this week. His claim is that each piece of new technology actually benefits the industry that initially seeks to quash it. VCR maybe being Exhibit A.
The VCR wasn't based on a business model encouraging people to copy illegally. Yes, granted, you could do some of that there, but that wasn't the reason why it existed. This technology is based upon encouraging people to illegally infringe copyright material. I mean, it's to take movies and music for free.
However, to get rid of peer-to-peer network technology would also, for example, outlaw BitTorrent, which enables anyone with a large video file to upload it, which would stop the video revolution on the internet, you know, more or less overnight.
No, none of this would automatically do that. You can't extrapolate to all internet issues or all peer-to-peer because it's not accurate. The other models you talked about may or may not be based on theft. The issue is, are the people who write the music, who make the books, the software in the movies, are they compensated for their works? And, you know, our copyright law, starting with our constitutional system, was built on the fact that people would be compensated for creating things.
It's a tough situation. As an owner myself of my own intellectual property, not very valuable, but nonetheless, I'm the owner of it, and I get steamed when someone infringes on it. But there's also the question of technology marching on.
Sure.
What happens if the court comes back and rules, well, we're sorry, movie industry, but technology must march on?
What we hope is the court strikes a balance here, and I think that's what they'll do. We in the movie industry, and I think in the music industry as well, are moving ahead with technology that will provide a reasonable cost, legal, hassle-free ways to get content from the internet. And there are lots of ways to do it. In our industry, we have services like MovieLink and Cinema Now. Netflix is now doing this. I suspect you're going to see a whole array of additional services, regardless of what the court does.
Now, I understand that we're talking about theft here. But I also see that the movie industry has been thriving in the past 5 years when piracy has been at its historical zenith. Is it possible that the criminals are actually, in a backdoor way, helping you by sampling your product for those who otherwise would not buy it and giving them an appetite for more Hollywood all the time?
I don't think it works that way. In the first place, our theatrical movies, you know, the movies you go to the movie theaters, it's actually been pretty flat over the last few years. We estimate that physical piracy, the optical discs on the street that you'd see, costs us somewhere around $3.5 billion a year. We're currently doing a look-see to determine the absolute effect of internet piracy. But with technology changing, with broadband width becoming larger and larger, it is likely that this will have a dramatic effect on movies in the future. Right now, a lot of folks don't want to spend the time to download a two-hour movie. But if you could do that in a minute, it would be a lot more attractive. And that's what's probably going to come down the pike soon.
you came from the Midwest. You're from Kansas, which is flyover country in a world where cultural values have become a very important currency. There seems to be a great rift between those in the red states and the blue, blah, blah, blah. Tell me about how that affects your membership. I'm thinking particularly of the movie ratings imposed in order to stave off interference from the government.
Well, the movie rating system works very well. I support it strongly. If you look at the top five movies last year, four of them were PG or PG-13. Only one was an R, and that movie was The Passion of the Christ. So it's clear that the movie industry is making more and more family entertainment films, which the American people find very, very attractive right now.
What about ratings creep? I've sat in films that were rated PG-13 and seen material that when I was 13, I would have hidden under my bed from my mother.
I don't think there's been a ratings creep as much as what I call societal creep. We tolerate things today in American society that 50 years ago we would have probably thought was, you know, obscene behavior. Now, at the same time, the movie rating system wasn't written on Mount Sinai. It doesn't mean that we can't continue to look at it periodically to see if it needs to be tweaked.
I saw in one of the profiles of you that you're already conscious about the chances of appearing before a batrillion people on the Academy Awards broadcast in your new role. How's the audition been going so far?
I haven't received any inquiries yet, but where there's life, there's hope.
Well, Dan Glickman, thank you very much.
Okay, glad to be with you.
Dan Glickman, former Secretary of Agriculture, is President and CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America.
If you think of the internet as a vast library, it's hard to imagine a better card catalog than Google. Only not everyone wants in. A few weeks ago, the world's most popular search engine found itself on the receiving end of a lawsuit by the world's oldest news organization. Agence France-Presse, or AFP, is suing Google in the United States for an alleged violation of U.S. copyright law, essentially charging Google with stealing news content and repackaging it on Google's own subsidiary search engine called Google News. Could this mean the end of news searching as we know it? Here to explain it is University of Virginia Law Professor Tim Wu, who specializes in international copyright and technology. Tim, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to talk for a minute about an ancestor of this current lawsuit. A few years back, a French anti-racism group sued Yahoo.
Well, this is the famous Yahoo case, which was a landmark in internet law. And it basically concerned the fact that you were able to buy, in France, using the Yahoo auction site, Nazi paraphernalia, pictures of concentration camps, copies of Mein Kampf. And as you mentioned, a group brought a lawsuit, and they convinced a French court that Yahoo's activities were illegal under French law. Yahoo's first reaction was to say that this couldn't possibly affect them and that it was impossible to regulate the internet. But they soon changed their mind when the French court began demanding massive fines. And I think if you do a search today on eBay or on Yahoo, you'll notice that it's hard to find Nazi paraphernalia. So there's a history before this Google case of French plaintiffs controlling the activities of American internet companies.
Now, you've said that French lawsuits like these encourage a kind of balkanization of the internet, but I'm not sure what you mean by that.
If you have a series of lawsuits in France, the easiest way to comply with the lawsuits is to change what you offer French citizens as opposed to American citizens. So one way Yahoo could have complied with a Nazi lawsuit is to stop selling Nazi materials to French people, but allowing the sale to American people. Multiply that many times, and you have ultimately different internets for different countries.
So let's talk about the chances of AFP winning, which would, I guess, further the balkanization of the internet, as you might say. U.S. copyright law has a doctrine called fair use. Explain how that relates to this case.
Well, the United States has a particularly strong version of the fair use doctrine, and it essentially has stood for the idea that even though some things may be technically a violation of the copyright law, the courts will nonetheless give it a pass because it is a socially productive or desirable activity. Some of the most famous examples of fair use are parodies, book reviews. The Sony VCR is protected by fair use doctrine. The reason it's relevant to this case is that Google's main defense is that its use of the copyrighted materials of AFP, its limited use of the copyrighted materials, constitutes a fair use defense. And in fact, I think it's a very strong defense.
You do?
Yes.
But it isn't using it in the transformative way, to use the legal term that you described, that book reviews might. You know, a book review will quote from a book because they're in the process of creating a review. A parody would use material in order to take off from that. Google isn't transforming the material and creating a new product thereby. It's simply presenting you with the product. So how is that fair use?
I think Google, in fact, will argue that their usage is transformative. That is, they're giving you a little snippet to give you a preview of what you can get if you actually go to the news provider's site. And I think they will argue that this is a different service than provided by the newspaper itself. Similarly, the fact that they put and compile a whole series of newspapers together further strengthens their argument that they have transformed what was a series of disparate newspapers into a useful summary and a useful guide to what kind of news you can find today through Google.
Do you think that AFP might take this to French court if they lose in the U.S.?
That is a logical move, and I would suggest that AFP's chances in French court would be far better. It is, in fact, a little bit of a mystery that they haven't brought a case in French court. French plaintiffs have a good record of winning against America media defendants, leading ultimately, if they win in France and lose in the United States, to further balkanization of the Internet.
The French press has lately been using the neologism omni-Googlization, and I think that's a stand-in for American digital cultural imperialism.
I think some of those claims may be overrated, that the real reason for this lawsuit is a cultural war. There's also the fact that AFP perhaps hopes to make some money off this lawsuit. They have asked for millions of dollars of damages, and perhaps they hope that they could convince Google to actually pay for their news content, although I doubt Google would.
All right. Tim, thank you very much.
Sure.
Tim Wu is an associate professor of law at the University of Virginia.
Coming up, newspapers ask a wire service for help in keeping the news new, and a flap over female columnists, or the lack thereof.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org, the Melville Charitable Trust Foundation, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with an update. Listeners may recall that last week we discussed charges lobbed by several whistleblower groups that the ostensibly independent Office of Special Counsel has been improperly politicized. Recently, those groups have provided a case in point. Actually, two cases in point.
They point to the fact that complaints to the office last fall about campaign trips taken by Condoleezza Rice on the government's dime sat around for weeks until after the election. By contrast, a visit by John Kerry to the Kennedy Space Center that prompted similar complaints was processed in a zippy 2 days. This week, the FBI said it would investigate the office for charges of malfeasance and cronyism.
The The Associated Press recently advised its 1,700-member news organization that it will now offer two versions of many of its big news stories. The second version will be much the same as the original, except for its lead, which will be filled with imagery, narrative devices, and creative turns of phrase. The reason? Newspaper editors express concern that readers increasingly see the wire stories they run in their papers a day earlier on the Internet.
Or if you don't like that intro, maybe you'll like this more colorful version. With their readership plummeting and their revenues drying up, newspaper barons find themselves at the dawn of the 21st century, fearing for their very survival. In yet another desperate attempt to salvage their once grand industry from its Internet-induced death throes, they beseeched the Associated Press for help. And so, from now on, that august institution will provide its members with something a little fresher for their morning papers. The specter of the electronic media, explains AP managing editor Mike Silverman, looms large.
When a story happens Monday, most people are reading about it on Monday during the day at work or at home when they go online, or they're hearing about it on radio or TV. And when they pick up the newspaper Tuesday, they already know what happened. Newspapers have increasingly been asking for our help in strategies for finding ways to draw readers to the newspaper with approaches to news stories that are just a little bit different from the conventional 5 W's. That's what the optional lead concept is really about.
More analysis, more context, maybe a little bit more lively writing.
And an approach at the very top of the story that doesn't presume to be telling people what happened, but maybe leads them in through some imagery or, as you say, a context or analysis.
Give me an example, please, of what a substantial news story would sound like with the traditional AP lead and what one of the optional leads might look like.
I'll give you an example from last week. In our traditional version, France took a big step toward liberalizing its rigid labor laws Tuesday as lawmakers voted to effectively dismantle the 35-hour work week, cherished by workers but despised by many employers and potential investors. Then we came back a couple hours later with an optional approach that started off this way. France's 35-hour work week was cherished by workers but despised by many investors and employers. Now the bold social experiment has been dubbed a failure by France's parliament, et cetera, et cetera. And then when you get to the third graph, you find out the actual event that took place, which was that the National Assembly voted overwhelmingly to adopt a government-backed bill that waters it down.
I guess when you change the way you introduce yourself to a newspaper story reader, there is some risk attached. You're asking your reporters to write with more authority and to give readers the benefit of their expertise. I can also see how it could devolve into a sort of Fox Newsification of news stories, where subjective judgments do sort of find their way willy-nilly into leads or other parts of the news story. Are there warning signs that you're keeping your eye out for to make sure that this just doesn't mutate into the wrong thing?
Well, yes, it's called editors. Nothing ever gets out onto the AP wire without having gone through the eyes of one or more very skilled editors who look for exactly that kind of thing, as well as other issues with stories. So we're all very still committed to objectivity and accuracy and fairness, and we're not about to tolerate any kind of agenda setting on the wire.
Mike, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Mike Silverman is managing editor of the Associated Press.
Susan Estrich, professor at the University of Southern California, was growing increasingly irate that the Los Angeles Times featured so few women writers on its opinion pages, about 20%, which is still more than the New York Times and twice as much as the Washington Post. And she focused her ire on the widely admired LA Times opinion editor Michael Kinsley, ire that escalated into a series of emails sent to him and copied to others, including one saying that people had begun to believe Kinsley's Parkinson's disease may have affected his brain. I mean, yuck. bad choice of paper, bad choice of villain, really, really bad choice of tactics, but good issue? A score of women writers weighed in, disagreeing on such questions as whether women are inclined to the kind of toughness the opinion page demands, whether they ought to be nurtured, or whether they are already there, hiding in plain sight. Do women write differently? In 2003, we spoke to Clive Thompson about a newly developed algorithm that can predict a writer's sex about 80% of the time, based solely on how often they use words like you, me, and with.
The basic idea behind it was the discovery that women use personal pronouns a lot more than men do. Words like you, they, he, she. That's actually one of the most revealing indicators. If you were just to count those, you would probably have at least a half chance of being able to figure out whether it was a man or a woman that had written it.
But don't you have a half chance of figuring whether it's a man or a woman even if you don't count any words at all?
Okay, yeah, granted. But that's why they go on to count other things. You look at how many what are called determiners are used. Those are the things like the, some, more, and men use those more. The basic idea behind it, if you talk to the linguists who've looked at this study, is that it's like that old saw that women write about people and men write about things. And it seems crazy and completely hackneyed, and I'm sort of resistant to the idea a little bit when I first heard about it. But the numbers do add up. If you even go back a couple hundred years and look at the writings of women clerics, they'd be more likely to write sentences that said, I think this is true. Whereas a man would just state it. He would just state this is a fact. You know, he had complete confidence in himself. And so it's the inclusion of those things like I think that begin to introduce more personal pronouns into the way that women historically have written.
So hubris, thy name is man.
Yeah, basically. Exactly.
Actually, the first journal that the researchers submitted this research to rejected it on ideological grounds.
That's right. They thought it was potentially kind of sexist because they said you are suggesting that there are innate differences between men and women, and we don't know if that's true. I got to say, I started off being a little skeptical of this, partly because gender science has a long history of starting off with kind of a weird basic premise, which is that men and men or women and never the twain shall meet. And so when you go out looking for differences between men and women with that as your starting point, well, you're going to find them. I mean, in the same way that you could do a study saying, well, maybe old people and young people write differently. You'd probably find that too, quite frankly. Now, the scientists themselves are very careful. They're walking on eggshells here. They're very careful to say that they're not suggesting any reasons why this happens. They're all, you know, we're just about the numbers. We'll leave it to the philosophers to figure out why men and women do this differently. And that's where the linguists come in and say, well, men and women are, you know, sort of are trained to talk in different ways.
Now, what's really interesting is that words that you think would actually indicate gender, words that have meaning, words that have an emotional context, or words that pertain to certain subjects, those were eliminated before this evaluation of these pieces began.
Yeah, that's the kind of weird thing about this language analysis stuff. You would think, you know, if you're going to look at something I've written, like an article, that you'd be interested in looking at the major words, like the article I wrote. You think you might pay attention to words like computer or gender or whatever. But when people do these analyses to try and figure out who it was that wrote something, they strip all those big words out. They just leave the little stuff. The theory behind that is that when I'm writing an article, I'm paying attention to the big words. I'm paying attention to the words like computer or artificial intelligence, but I'm not paying attention to how I use words like the and but. Those things are literally unconscious, and because they're unconscious, they leave a fingerprint of who I am.
Well, how much does the intended audience of a piece of writing play into the gender specificity of the text? In other words, if you're writing for a man's magazine or you're writing for a women's magazine, does that muck up the question of these gender signifiers?
Yes, it does, actually. Deborah Tannen, the linguist who writes those books, You Just Don't Understand, Men and Women in Conversation, she studied a lot of how men and women talk differently. And her students once took a look at men's magazines and women's magazines. And it was very easy to spot when someone was trying to write for a men's magazine because they would use these very short sentences. And with women's magazines, they would be longer and they would have more of these pronouns. But the really weird thing was it didn't matter whether a man or a woman had written it, which is to say when women wrote for the men's magazines, they wrote as if they were trying to be a man communicating to men. So obviously there's some part of, you know, being a man or a woman that's about performing it as opposed to being it.
Okay. Clive, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clive Thompson is a New York Times Magazine contributing writer. Katha Pollitt is a columnist for The Nation who wrote recently about the issue of female columnists. Katha, how would your work fare in the Gender Detector?
Let's see. I'm looking at my column here. I see a lot of proper names, and I do see some pronouns. I don't know. It's a scary thought, isn't it? I don't think that they decide who gets to be on the op-ed page by looking at how often they say the. I think we are ourselves at every moment. We bring everything we have to the page. Men and women are raised rather differently and are given different senses of themselves, different senses of entitlement in different places. Women can be a little more emotional than men can be. It's kind of hard to imagine a man who's like Maureen Dowd, although there could be one.
Dowd herself wrote in the New York Times that men enjoy verbal dueling. I want to be liked, not attacked. Of course, others say that's no reason to disqualify you from the op-ed page.
What Maureen Dowd is basically saying is that there are many more men who want to do this kind of work than women who want to do this kind of work. I think there may be some truth to that if you look at, say, the slush pile, the pieces that just get sent in. I would say that whether or not there is a basic talent pool that is smaller in the case of women than in the case of men, that is not an important fact because the talent pool adjusts itself to where people think they can get somewhere. If women get the message, look, nobody wants to hear your opinions. And not only that, if you express an opinion, we're going to call you a stupid bitch or a feminazi, then women are going to maybe be a little more hesitant about that. But that doesn't mean they don't have opinions. That doesn't mean they wouldn't be very good at this kind of work.
In a piece you wrote in The Nation, you offered up about 20 names of women that newspapers could consider as columnists, including yourself. So have you gotten any calls?
No. I had a whole long list of wonderful women. They don't need to be nurtured and discovered, as Maureen and others have said. They're there. Barbara Ehrenreich filled in for Tom Friedman this summer. A lot of people think she did a better job than he did. When they expanded the op-ed page, they added more men. They didn't add her. There's my wonderful colleague, Patricia Williams. There's Susan Faludi. There's Sharon Lerner over at the Village Voice. She's really great. There's
Lefty.
Deborah Dickerson, not a lefty. Wendy Kaminer, Ruth Conniff, Laura Flanders. These people are out there, and they are not getting the jobs. And I think part of it is that the women I've mentioned are liberal and they're feminists. And that's not flavor of the month now. Now there is this perception that, oh, feminism, been there, done that.
So you're saying then that it's not a bull market for liberals right now.
Yeah, but, you know, then you take someone like Dahlia Lithwick, who is great over at Slate. I wouldn't know how to characterize her politically.
But she does have a relatively narrow brief, basically legal issues.
Well, you might just as well say that Tom Friedman only talks about foreign policy. I mean, people do have briefs on op-ed pages.
What do you think about what Michael Kinsley said when he wrote in his paper that if pressure for more women succeeds, as it will, there'll be fewer black voices, fewer Latinos, and so on? Does this strike you as a fair statement? Is it really a zero-sum game, realistically?
Well, realistically, the op-ed page is only so big. But what wonderful Michael Kinsley, who I really think is fabulous, is forgetting for one tiny moment here is that the number of white men is not fixed. I mean, it's as though he thinks, well, we can have six columnists, and of course, four of them are going to be white men, so that only leaves two spaces for the rest of humanity, and they'll be all fighting it out together, but it doesn't have to be that way. Men are allowed to be all different kinds of writers. And women, there's the question, can they fit into whatever the idea du jour is of what a woman columnist can be? Because they're always labeled women. But women are interested in some issues that men are not so interested in. And I do think that, and this is not some innate thing in their genes, this has to do with a different life experience. And I think that there are many very important subjects that get short shrift.
With the exception of Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune and Kinsley himself, very few men have weighed in on this debate. If men are so opinionated, why aren't we hearing from them?
Well, I think you should ask a man, a man who's been very, very quiet. Why should they call attention to themselves by saying, well, here, girls, is why I have this job and you don't?
Katha, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Katha Pollitt is a writer for The Nation, where women columnists outnumber men 3-2.
This week we learned that the White House Press Corps may finally get their old digs renovated. Reporters have complained about the drab and airless press room built over a defunct swimming pool for years. And at least on this subject, the president agrees with the media.
Whoever thought about modernizing this room deserves a lot of credit. Like there's very little oxygen in here anymore.
The plan for the renovation includes a suggested temporary relocation of the press corps to offices outside the White House. This doesn't sit well with some who believe this is just another way to cut their already diminishing access to the president. Still, most agree that modernization is desperately overdue. For instance, the briefing room doesn't even have a high-speed internet connection.
For an overhaul this daunting, maybe Joe Hagan, the deputy chief of staff who reportedly had this idea, should consider bringing in the team of ABC's Extreme Makeover Home Edition, or White House Edition.
Next week on Extreme Makeover Home Edition.
Let's get this party started!
It is a complicated project. It's going to be a really big project.
There goes the pool!
It was already drained, and it was basically a waste of space.
This is great, you know, because we only had one computer before and they all had to share.
I go on the internet now. I don't have to wait.
I'm like amazed by what you guys did for us, and my words can't describe how thankful I am.
To find out more about the products used, go to abc.com. Keyword home makeover.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.